This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So the prime example right now, they've submitted a biochar methodology to the Alberta Offset Scheme, which is mostly geared towards offsetting the tar sands emissions, the emissions from tar sands extraction in Alberta, which is one of the worst, most destructive, most polluting projects on the surface of the earth. And they're saying, you know, you could use bury some biochar in the ground to offset that pollution, which is really pretty outrageous given how little we know about the reliability of biochar, for one thing, and secondly, given that offsetting pollution is not, you know, a viable approach to dealing with a climate crisis at this point. We need to actually get rid of those emissions and those sources of pollution.
And the trees that they're looking at commercializing are actually eucalyptus trees, which, first of all, are not native to the North American continent or anywhere in the world except for Australia. But industry loves them because they're fast growing. And so they've been manipulating them to be cold tolerant so that they can actually grow all along the Gulf Coast of the United States, where they've never been able to grow before. And we believe it's very dangerous. Not only are these things very invasive, as anybody in California already knows, but they're extremely flammable, and they suck up a lot of groundwater. You know, wildlife can't live in these places, and yet, you know, international paper is talking about doubling the acreage of plantations in the southeast from 42 million acres to 84 million acres using these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees.
You know, just to think that one accident contaminated a whole continent is just almost beyond belief. And it's going to happen again. And I may say that the next nuclear meltdown, if it's in a Western country like Europe or America, that will mark the end of nuclear power. That'll be it.
This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. We are filling in for Earthbeat host Daphne Wisham, who is trying to raise sufficient funds to return to the air. On today's broadcast, you will get a taste of the kinds of interviews Daphne has done and continues to do for us as a volunteer for Radio EcoShock. If you would like to see both Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat continue with this kind of reporting, please visit the earthbeatradio.org website to find out how you can contribute. On today's program, two important new interviews from Daphne on the road. Rachel Smoker will describe a developing scheme to use untested biochar theory to offset the dirty tar sands in Canada. Is biochar for real? Then Daphne talks with Ann Peterman about industrializing our forests with genetically engineered trees. Once they are out there in the wild, there is no return. We'll wrap up with the Best of Earthbeat interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who explains the big risks in nuclear power long before the reactors at Fukushima, Japan, melted down. In our first interview, you get a new look at biochar and the big companies who want to sell it as a solution to climate change.
This is Daphne Wisham. I'm speaking with Rachel Smoker. She's the co-director of Biofuel Watch. And Rachel, you've just come out with a report on biochar. I wonder if you can explain for our listeners, first of all, what is biochar?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's one that we actually found was more difficult to answer than we thought. Biochar, the idea is that you take some kind of biomass, like some wood, for example, and you burn it with limited oxygen, and you get essentially charcoal. This is how we make charcoal, traditional charcoal as well. But the word is usually used to refer to taking that charcoal and burying it under soil. In other words, it's defined by how it's used rather than what the material is, really. Most of the time, the idea is that by burying that charcoal, which has a lot of carbon in it, you can bury it underground and sequester the carbon away from the atmosphere, which is part of the reason why it's been promoted as a solution to climate change. The reality is that most of the biochar that has been tested is either charcoal that's been made through traditional charcoal processes or charcoal that's left over even from Sweden agriculture, slash and burn agriculture, or wildfires, naturally occurring wildfires. if biochar were to be used on a large scale, it would be produced using pyrolysis facilities, which, you know, are just burners, essentially, that have the ability to control the temperature and the oxygen flow. And what people are finding is that the very particular details of how this material, the characteristics, the chemical and structural characteristics of this material actually make a huge difference in how it behaves in the soils. Because, you know, you can get anything from very fine particles to particles that have, that still retain a lot of the structure of the material that it was made from the wood, you know, the structure of the wood. It really is very variable, and it depends a lot on what it's made from, what temperature it's raised to, how quickly it's cooled, and other factors.
So where is the push for the use of biochar coming from? Who has such an interest in promoting biochar as a so-called solution to climate change?
Well, it's kind of grown out of, I'd say the main body is the International Biochar Initiative, which is kind of a conglomeration, if you will, of academics, soil scientists. There's also carbon market consultants and some bioenergy companies, startup companies that are involved with that. It's kind of a hybrid organization. And there's also just a lot of, I don't know, enthusiasts, I would say, who are looking for some kind of a, you know, viable, farmer-friendly solution to climate change.
And is this a viable farmer-friendly solution?
Well, I would say no. You know, I think, of course, farmers have the right to try it and see how it works. But we just did, in this report, we did a review of some of the scientific research that's been done. And we especially focused on field studies because we feel that the only meaningful results are studies that come from using natural soils, not sterile soils. They're not under laboratory conditions. They're under natural, you know, conditions that would happen in the real world. And there's very few of those studies, actually, it turns out. There's only about 13 peer-reviewed studies. 11 of those are based on 11 different field trials that have been done in different places around the world. And the results from those have been incredibly mixed, you know, ranging from really astonishingly poor results to, in some cases, you know, showing that some carbon had been retained in the soil or that yields had been increased. That's another claim that's made about biochar is that it improves the fertility of the soil and therefore, you know, you get better crop growth from soils that biochar has been added to. Those are really the two main claims that are made about it, sequestering carbon and increasing soil fertility. And so those were the two things we really looked at closely, and we found the results to be very, very mixed and very mixed in very surprising ways. There were some, for example, on one study that was done in Colombia where they added really enormous quantities of biochar. I think it was something in the order of 20 tons per hectare, and came back, you know, 2 years later and found that there was no elevation in the soil carbon. So, and then there's other studies where there does appear to be some elevation in the soil carbon, but it's very mixed. And part of the reason it's mixed is because some of that biochar apparently is lost to wind and water erosion. Some of it migrates deeper down into the soils where it can't be really found anymore. And some of it ends up just oxidizing and being lost back out into the atmosphere. In other words, it's labile. It's not stable. And, you know, you have to realize that the biochar enthusiasts are claiming that biochar will sequester carbon reliably in soils for hundreds or even thousands of years. So it's really important to look at the field studies and see what the results are supporting those claims. And they're astonishingly weak at this point.
So what's the danger here? I mean, it sounds like the studies are mixed. There are some studies that suggest carbon may be sequestered in the soil, others that suggest it may not. Why not just let the scientists continue with their studies and see where all the dust settles eventually?
Well, that would be fine. You know, if some scientists wanted to continue to study biochar, that would be no problem. But the thing is, they're advocating for this as a very large scale. Their vision is to scale this up, you know, as a technology for climate geoengineering. And they published a paper at the end of 2010 in Nature Communications where they said, oh, we can you know, sustainably harvest enough biomass from the surface of the earth that we could draw down the global greenhouse gas emissions by 12% annually.
Who's they?
They being members of the IBA, the International Biochar Initiative, and the authors of this paper. So you know, they have a very large-scale vision of promoting this, you know, on a very large scale, and they're seeking supports for it through the carbon markets, which would mean that biochar would be offered up as essentially as an offset for polluters. So the prime example right now, they've submitted a biochar methodology to the Alberta Offset Scheme, which is mostly geared towards offsetting the tar sands emissions, the emissions from tar sands extraction in Alberta, which is one of the worst, most destructive, most polluting projects on the surface of the earth. And they're saying, you know, you could use bury some biochar in the ground to offset that pollution, which is really pretty outrageous given how little we know about the reliability of biochar, for one thing, and secondly, given that offsetting pollution is not a viable, you know, viable approach to dealing with a climate crisis at this point. We need to actually get rid of those emissions and those sources of pollution.
So the International Biochar Initiative is proposing that Alberta's tar sands be offset with biochar?
Well, there's members of the International Biochar Initiative who are involved with that. The funding for that is actually coming from ConocoPhillips and the Carbon War Room, Richard Branson, who's, you know, a biofuels entrepreneur. That's where the funding for developing standards for biochar and for developing this methodology for the Alberta offset scheme is coming from. They're looking for, you know, inexpensive ways to offset that massive polluting destructive project, and thinking that biochar might be one of them.
So if they were to proceed with this biochar offset scheme for Alberta's tar sands, where exactly do they propose to bury all of this biochar, and how much wood and other biomass would they need to burn to offset the tar sands?
That's a really good question, and it would be really monumental. The reality is that when you make biochar, somewhere around 12 to maybe, if you're lucky, up to 40% of the carbon in the wood that you use or the other biomass is retained in the charcoal. So the rest of it goes off into both a gaseous form and an oil form, and that can be used for bioenergy if it's further used. But the point is just that only a small portion of the carbon in that initial, you know, say you take one tree, only 12 to 40% of the carbon in the tree will be retained in the char. Mm-hmm. So, and it takes a lot of char to sequester any significant amount of carbon in the soil, assuming that you believe that it'll actually stay in the soil, which so far the evidence doesn't even support that. So it would take massive amounts of land. I mentioned before this study that was published in Nature Communications where they said, you know, the theoretical potential for biochar of drawing down 12% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And hidden in the very fine print in the supplementary materials and through, in, you know, searching out the references, we eventually concluded that actually what they were calling for was the conversion of 556 million hectares of land to biochar feedstock production. So, you know, this is part of this general blueprint that people have been using for making assessments and decisions about how to make, you know, not only biochar but biofuels in general, where the assumptions are that there's massive amounts of land that are, you know, available to produce feedstocks for these visions, be it biochar or biofuels or biomass, electricity, whatever. And they basically sort of look at the surface of the earth and they say, oh, there's, you know, millions of hectares of land. Usually it's in Africa and in Latin America that's available for us to grow our feedstocks and make the materials that are needed. It's just not a very realistic vision.
So 556 million hectares is what? How would you compare that to, say, the size of India?
I think it's larger than India, actually, 556 million hectares.
So there have been 11 field trials, according to your report that has just come out. And the name of your report is?
It's called Biochar, a Critical Review of Science and Policy.
So there have been 11 field trials that exist of biochar, and only five have looked at what happens to the soil carbon when biochar is added. in your mind, is this not adequate, that, you know, that there have been 11 field trials and only 5 looking at soil carbon? Or is this sort of standard operating procedure for scientists to move forward in this fashion?
It's certainly not standard operating procedure for scientists to propose really scaling up any technology on the basis of such limited knowledge, and especially given that even just the small number of studies, those 5, don't even have consistent results that support the claims that are being made about biochar being stable in soils for hundreds to thousands of years. Those claims are based on drawing an analogy with the Terra Preta soils from the Amazon, which are soils that were created by indigenous people in the Amazon, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago. And they used charcoal in those soils, but they also used a lot of other materials. There's pottery shards and animal bones and compost and human waste and various other things also in those soils. And the process for creating those soils is something we don't know how that was done. But now, even, you know, thousands of years later, those soils are very fertile and have a lot of charcoal retained in them. Mm. But modern biochar, just producing some char through a pyrolysis process and burying it in the soil, is not the same process.
Now, one of the topics that you explore in your report is the notion that biochar has ancillary benefits for the poor, that both it helps sequester carbon in soils, but it also creates, as you've been suggesting, soil fertility, and for subsistence farmers in the developing world, this is a good thing. Talk about how biochar is being promoted as sort of a poverty alleviation approach to addressing agricultural shortages in the developing world.
Right. Well, as you know, there's a lot of interest now in agriculture in general and in trying to sort of ramp up production in places like Africa where the food crisis is so severe. And biochar is just one of the technologies that's kind of in the mix, I guess I would say. It's been promoted on a couple of different fronts. One is that it's been promoted, you know, just as a way of improving soil fertility and therefore improving crop yields for people. And there's been a number of different trials that have been done. And these are not really scientific trials. They're just kind of, you know, small-scale trials done by different groups. So there's been a number of trials, actually. We looked at, for example, we did a bit of a review of projects in Africa and found that I think there were something like 28 relatively small-scale trials happening around in Africa on biochar. And, you know, these are presented very much as being beneficial to the poor. You know, some of these trials also are based on the assumption that slash-and-burn agriculture is a leading cause of deforestation and that we should try and address that by replacing slash-and-burn with slash-and-char agriculture. If you were to take the materials that would have been burned and instead make biochar out of them and put the char in the soils will stay fertile for longer, and the need to clear more forest will be postponed or even halted if you're really lucky. So again, this is based, again, on the assumption that putting biochar in the soil is, in fact, going to improve the soil fertility, when there's not that much evidence to support that claim in the first place. There's also, you know, the underlying assumption that slash-and-burn agriculture is a leading cause of deforestation. I mean, there's no question that it's problematic in some places, but there's also no question that deforestation is more a problem of industrial forestry practices and excessive demand for wood products in the developed world rather than these very, very poor farmers who are eking out a living on the edges of the forest and practicing slash-and-burn agriculture. But in any case, again, it's based on the assumption that it's going to improve soil fertility, which is not necessarily a good assumption. Another place where we see the pro-poor biochar promotion is in cookstoves. Cookstoves that produce biochar have been promoted as being more efficient and cleaner. And they're certainly probably more efficient and cleaner than just cooking on an open cook fire. But the real comparison should be with other efficient cookstoves. And as I said before, if you make biochar, you retain some portion of the carbon in the material as char, which means in a cookstove context, that means that that amount of that biomass did not go into cooking energy. It was retained as char instead. So relative to other cookstoves that would have used the entire content of the biomass as cook energy, they're less efficient.
And they're promoted, you know, also again on the basis of the idea that, well, these farmers, you know, it's cleaner and it's more efficient, and then they will have this wonderful material, this char residue, which they can put back in the soils, which will help them to grow more biomass so that they can continue cooking with that. But cooking on a cook stove produces a very, very, very small amount of char. And we did some calculations just to look at, you know, how much char would be produced from by these cook stoves and how long it would take. And it would take a family, you know, years to produce enough biochar to add to just improve the soils in 1 hectare of land. It would take them years and years of cooking 3 times a day to get enough biochar, because it takes, you know, several tons of biochar to get any impact on the soils in places where it has shown some improvement in the soils. It takes a large amount to do that. So these cook stoves are not going to produce enough biochar to actually really influence the productivity of the land for these people.
So what would you recommend instead? Would you recommend gas stoves with fossil fuels, or would you recommend biogas stoves? Or what are the alternatives that are better for the environment, better for the poor, better for cooking?
Well, there's no question that more efficient stoves are needed and are a good solution. It's just a question of which stoves are the most efficient. And advocating for a biochar producing stove as being a good option is not necessarily, you know, the best choice. Mm-hmm. Again, if you have an efficient stove that uses biomass but uses all of the energy from the biomass for cooking, then that's probably a better option than making biochar.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of slash and burn agriculture, one of the things that rarely gets mentioned when people condemn slash and burn agriculture in the Amazon is the role of biofuels, in particular sugarcane and other fuels that are being turned into energy for automobiles in that slash and burn agriculture. I wonder if you can just speak quickly on that topic.
The extension of the agricultural frontiers almost always is coming at the expense of forested land at this point. So if there's more demand for plant biomass, mm-hmm. for fueling cars, for making biochar, for fueling an entire bioeconomy where we substitute plant biomass as a source of energy for virtually everything that we use fossil fuels for now, all of that has to come out of, you know, at the expense of some other land.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the funding that's going towards some of these biochar initiatives involving cook stoves and other trials to try to sequester carbon in the soil, where is most of the money coming from?
Well, surprisingly, they've been looking for that and have so far not really been too successful. I think the main focus was in trying to get biochar accepted into some of the carbon trading schemes. Mm-hmm. There was a push within the UN to get biochar accepted in, for example, into the Clean Development Mechanism and get carbon finance through that. So far, that hasn't been successful. There's been methodologies submitted, as I said, to the Alberta Offset Scheme and to a number of other, the Verified Carbon Standard and other carbon trading schemes, with the idea that this would be the way to get funding to scale up biochar production. But so far, that funding hasn't been forthcoming, and there's a lot of question about how the future of carbon markets in general. So the biochar lobby has been kind of shifting their focus lately to a kind of a broader approach, that biochar has all these different benefits, you know, reducing fertilizer use and doing helping soils to retain water and all these other things, which they claim to be the case, whether there's any scientific evidence for that or not. But so they're seeking to kind of broaden the vision away from just sequestering carbon, but to all these other roles that they believe biochar could play. And they're doing that in part because there's increasing discussions about how agriculture could be brought into the carbon markets in general and is receiving a lot of funding through various different initiatives. And this would mean funding would come in for promoting carbon or climate-friendly agriculture practices. The enthusiasts are hoping that biochar will be funded under that umbrella.
Did you want to mention the Gates Foundation or any of that stuff?
Yeah. One of the significant pieces of funding that has come through is from the Gates Foundation, which offered a large grant to Cornell University. Cornell University has played a lead role in the Green Revolution, the current Alliance for a Green Revolution for Africa. These agriculture initiatives are worrying because they promote a sort of a vision of improving agriculture practices, for example, in Africa, by introducing genetically modified crops and various other kind of intensive industrial monoculture practices, which they see as the way to improve productivity in places like Africa. Whereas there are a lot of other people who believe that what's needed is something quite different. What's needed is support for peasant agriculture, essentially, for very diverse agroecological, for local production, local consumption, not these industrial monocultures that are designed for providing feed for cattle for people on the other side of the planet, for example.
So what can people do, given that this is sort of in the realm of science and abstractions and pipe dreams for ConocoPhillips and others? How should people proceed?
Well, I think people just need to be really, really, really cautious about how things are presented as, you know, green alternatives and green solutions to problems. And, you know, when you think about it, it's really common sense. As these people are advocating that we use charcoal to cool down a warming planet. And that just, you know, when you think of it in those terms, it doesn't make sense. When you look around and you see, you know, what looks like a healthy planet is a place that's got a nice, you know, healthy growing forest. It's not a place that has industrial monocultures for, you know, wood production. We know very well at this point that we need to restore and protect the ecosystems that we have remaining and hopefully improve on it, not create huge new demands for biomass as an alternative to fossil fuels.
Thanks for speaking with us today. I've been speaking with Rachel Smoker. She's the co-director of Biofuel Watch. They are just out with a recent report on biochar called A Critical Review of Biochar Science and Policy, which you can download from their website, biofuelwatch.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with interviews from Daphne Washam, host of Earthbeat Radio. As the producer of Radio EcoShock, I can tell you Daphne Washam is an American gem for reporting on the environment. We need her voice and the original stories she uncovers, like those you are hearing today. Find out how you can help at earthbeatradio.org. Let's get back to our second new interview from Daphne. Big corporations plan to industrialize our forests. They'll do it by changing the very nature of trees with genetic engineering. Unless we say no. Here's Daphne Washam.
Ann Peterman is the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. I'm speaking with her in Vermont at her home office. Ann, you have been working on the issue of genetically engineered trees. And I would venture a guess that most people don't realize that there is such a thing as genetically engineered trees. Tell us about your work.
Well, we've been working on the issue of genetically engineered trees since we first found out about them in 1999. And since then, the focus has really been trying to keep them out of the environment. So they've got, in the United States, is the country that's at the leading edge of pushing this technology globally. There have been over 300 test plots of genetically engineered trees in the United States and also elsewhere around the world, but mainly here. And that they're getting closer and closer to the point where they want to commercialize them. In other words, sell them by the billions for planting in mass monoculture tree plantations for a variety of purposes, from wood-burning electricity to paper to biomass-based products like chemicals and textiles and so forth. So anyway, the idea is that, from our perspective, is that this can never happen. These are far too dangerous, these trees, to let them out in the environment. And so we have been working, as the Stop GE Trees campaign, with attorneys from the Center for Food Safety and the Center for Biological Diversity to actually sue the USDA to try to stop a massive field trial that we believe is the next step that industry is taking toward commercialization.
You are listening to Ann Peterman describing the new industrial forests and their risk to the wild. The reporter is Daphne Washam of Earthbeat at earthbeatradio.org. I'm Alex Smith, and we'll be right back with more, including a warning from anti-nuclear activist Dr. Helen Caldicott. Stay tuned.